From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in Exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
You're tuned to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, KPFT, FM 90.1, and KPFT HD Digital Channel 1. This is Houston's community station. We thank you for joining us. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Rick Campbell. For nearly a week in mid-February, most of the state suffered through sub-freezing temperatures. Millions lost power and heat, and when the pipes burst and the water systems were forced to shut down, many of us had to do without fresh drinking water and had to finally start boiling water. Just this week, the New York Times reported that 111 people have died in the freeze, almost doubling the number of deaths officials had reported earlier. A month and a half since the freeze hit Texas, we're still trying to make sense of what happened. A decade ago, University of Houston energy fellow Ed Hirsch predicted that this failure would happen. He is an energy economics professor at U of H, and he's with us today to help us understand how the system collapsed, the fallout since then, and what can be done to prevent this from happening in the future. Ed Hirsch, welcome to Open Journal.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, Rick.
It's great to have you on board, Ed. Seems like the obvious first question. What exactly happened to the power grid and how did we get there? There's a lot of questions that will stem from that one opening move.
Well, it was a systemic failure. Generators not being able to respond when everybody switched on their heaters and lights and stoves and ovens, and basically we wound up getting to a summertime peak in February. The equipment wasn't ready to go. The grid manager, in this case, you know, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, began to do what it had to do to preserve the integrity of what it could manage. So they began shutting down different parts of the grid across the state of Texas, ultimately culminating in basically delivering only 60% of what was demanded by the consumers in Texas. 30 gigawatts of generation capacity was offline, and many tragedies occurred as a result of that.
On a personal note, how did it impact you? Were you frozen? Were you in a bad way, as many of us were? I just got hot water back a couple weeks ago.
Well, now there's a comment for you. 25 hours.
Did you have any animals to keep you comfortable and warm through this?
It was a two-dog night, complete with additional family members and almost family members moving in. Even though we were without power and things got a little chilly, let me get some treats.
Cheese break.
You rascal, you.
You know, he's got almost 21,000 followers on Instagram.
Wow, really?
All right, will you behave yourself? So we began the debacle with the power was out for 25 hours. And then it was off more than it was on for the next 3 days. And then, coupled with the water loss and all things considered, we did okay. I mean, we were inconvenienced, just had the last pipe, I hope, fixed in the apartment building yesterday. So I have reliable hot water again. But, we were very fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ed, you've written that the Texas power grid was destined to fail. What was it about this that made you think that it would inevitably fail, as it seems to have or nearly completely did?
Well, yeah, the simple thing is that the generators weren't making enough money to cover their cost. And so for more than 10 years, the revenues that the generators have received have essentially been less than their cost of providing the electricity to us. In a macro sense like that, it's inevitable when a system doesn't provide any kind of incentive for reinvestment or new investment, it's going to collapse over time. That's the same with any sort of economic enterprise, utility, water system, sewer system, even your automobile. If you don't replace the tires, change the oil, keep things going, yeah, you're going to have a failure.
Most of Texas is on a power grid that's not connected to any other state. And officials have said they don't want electricity in Texas to be under federal control. Which is worse, an unreliable grid or federal control?
Well, let me say that federal control would not be the panacea that some folks have said that it would be. As our grid went down, we were down 30 gigawatts. The Western Interconnect had at most 6 gigawatts of spare capacity if we could have accessed it. That wouldn't have helped us. Quite honestly, until Texas can fix its own grid, nobody would want to have us connected to them. One of the great challenges with the Eastern Interconnect, if you will, is there was a tree trimming incident in Cleveland that took down the grid all on the Atlantic seaboard several years ago. And then not too long ago, an operator pushed the wrong button in Arizona, took down Arizona and Southern California. So, there are pluses and minuses to interconnecting with other parts of the grid. The federal regulation, really is not that much of a tremendous boon. You would expect that in a state that's focused on commerce, that's focused on economic development, that we could manage a grid of our own. I mean, this is the state that has an economic engine larger than most nations. Our grid is larger than most nations. The fact that the legislature and, three governors don't quite get it is really just astonishing.
Mm-hmm. In retrospect, was electrical deregulation in Texas such a wise idea?
No, and it's not deregulation. I like to say it's just regulated differently. If I were to remove the speed limit on 610 tomorrow, I would stand up as a clever politician and say, hey, 610 is deregulated. But you and I and all the listeners understand that that would be a real problem. We just couldn't get out on 610 and drive at any speed at any time of the day or night or in any weather conditions. It just changed the incentives. And so Texas followed the example of loosening up parts of the market like California did. California was following the example of Australia in the 1980s. Australia deregulated their market, went to a disintegrated electrical system, and found that it didn't work very well. They had so many blackouts, so many equipment failures, business failures in their electricity grid, that they wound up re-regulating even before California kicked off their so-called deregulation. The California process began in 1993, it was implemented in 1996. It brought with it the famed California energy crisis of 2000-2001. For those of us here in town at the time, we remember how Enron played that game, buying electricity at 9 cents a kilowatt hour, selling it back to California at 22 cents a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. Essentially, creaming hundreds of millions of dollars off of the California grid, and prolonging the life of Enron for that year. As we saw in California, they recovered a bit. They've changed the rules of their market. And Governor Gray Davis was voted out. The gubernator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, mm-hmm. was elected. California has new problems with its grid from other misdirected attempts to kind of lessen the cost, if you will. And the way I put it is California's chosen cheap over reliable. And now Governor Gavin Newsom is subject to a recall election this summer. So Texas did not change anything. And as we went down that path, started under Governor Bush and then fully implemented under Governor Perry, we put in place the key element of the ERCOT market, which is an electricity-only market. And as we split the generators off to one side, the customers were placed in another side. Customers were serviced by resellers. You know, it's an interesting idea or concept that it's a competitive market for consumers, because an electron's an electron is electron. It's, you know, electrons don't know how they were made. You don't know how they're transported. And, you know, a couple of years ago, even the chairman of the Texas Public Utility Commission, Deanne Walker, said she couldn't understand the retail side of things. The bulk of your electricity bill, for the most part, remains fully regulated, the transmission lines, the local distribution company, which for us is CenterPoint. These entities get a regulated rate of return. They have to go to the Public Utility Commission every time they ask for a rate increase or a change. Interestingly, the last time CenterPoint did that, which was about a year ago, the Public Utility Commission slammed them because their service in particular was unreliable. AGB complained about it and had pointed out that they had had to bring in their own generators to power their stores. But I'm a little off. We got to get back to the generators. So the generators were placed out to the side. You know, some sharp MBAs had pointed out that, goodness, you know, a lot of these generators stand idle throughout the rest of the year. And they're available for August, but then not turning in September through to June or July. And therefore, they're not needed. And why should we be paying to keep this equipment idle? And we had built up the generation in advance of the great growth of Texas in population and commerce. And so, yeah, there was probably a good cushion available when everyone started talking about this in the 90s. As they went forward with the electricity-only market side of things, I like to describe this in terms of, say, the Houston Astros. If the Astros were compensated on an electricity-only basis, then only those 10 players on the field during the game that day are going to make any money. The others on the bench are not paid. They're not paid to be ready to come in. You know, presumably they're having hot dogs and soft drinks. And the only way you get into a game then would be to bid in the next day. And eventually, if you don't play, you go hungry. So the generators face a market like that. ERCOT is facing a huge supply of generation most of the time. So for 11 months out of the year, there are more generators available to come into the market than we need on a daily basis. And so they make the choice based on price. And, you know, some generation companies do really well at low prices. Wind energy, for example, comes in at a very, very competitive price. In fact, bids in at a negative price, actually pays ERCOT to take their electricity because of the production tax credit. And then nuclear plants, there's really no way to cut cost at a nuclear power plant. It's pretty well fixed for the next 40, 50 years. They bid in, and they've had to bid in at a price that generally is less than their cost of capital. And then the coal plants have been kind of pushed off. And then the more expensive natural gas plants have also left the grid. And so if there's no real way to make a return on investment over time, supply will diminish. People will leave the market. And that's what we had here. Of 10 years of an average price less than the average total cost of providing generation, it led to attrition and generation companies leaving the ERCOT grid. As you would leave a grid, you would expect over time that prices would begin to rise. And we could get into a situation where there's a short squeeze. In other words, we could hit a point where the demand is greater than what the supply can be. We would also expect that if equipment's unable to come on. We would also expect that on sometimes a day-to-day basis when some of the generation companies might manipulate the market when they find that they're in a position to do so. And there have been numerous instances of this on the Texas grid over the years. Most tellingly, one company, I guess, in 2013, 2014, pulled about $300 million out of the Texas grid. ERCOT allowed that. There were no prosecutions. Ordinarily, under a federal jurisdiction, that would have been illegal to do. But in Texas, it wasn't a big problem. You know, you and I, we each lost about $19 each that year if we had a meter. You know, if we had walked out of Austin with $300 million, I don't think we would have made it to Bastrop. But this generation company did. They were called on it by a commodities trading company here in Houston. Instantly, they changed the name of the company, and then the parents sold that little unit out as fast as they could. You know, the whole system's been kind of rife with payoffs for different sorts of entities who were not looking after the consumer. And so how do we know this? Well, in a number of pieces chronicling ERCOT's issues over the last several years in the Houston Chronicle by the journalist L.M. Sixel, she outlined the fact that Texans were spending more money for their electricity than consumers in fully regulated markets. The Wall Street Journal, a little late to the game, came up with this a couple of weeks ago and said, my goodness, Texans have spent $28 billion more than they would have if they'd stayed in a regulated framework. And then, of course, the week of the great debacle, the great tragedies, the 111 people paid with their lives, Texans paid $50 billion, several years worth of electricity payments in the course of a few days. And one estimate is $90 billion in property and casualty losses. This is just astonishing. So the price was allowed to go, or was set by ERCOT and the Public Utility Commission at the cap. So $9,000 a megawatt hour. So roughly 300 times the average price paid during a given year, 300 times a premium. Texans only got 60% of what we bargained for. So, you know, this market was structured to fail by not giving generation companies an adequate rate of return over the 10 years before. It led to a lack of reinvestment, a lack of investment in new equipment. Then eventually it got to a point where a stress was going to break the system. We had seen this in February of 2011. The grid collapsed due to a blue norther, a polar vortex that dipped into Texas. ERCOT triggered all sorts of blackouts across the grid, and mainly in North Texas. It didn't quite reach to Houston. The most that some people remember is that the Super Bowl was inconvenienced because Arlington was part of the blackout, but you know, the blackout extended across the Dallas Medical Center with tragic results then. There were hearings in Austin. Great politicians and all convened to say weighty things. There's a 350-odd page report from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, which is part of FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, with specific recommendations for Texas to strengthen and make its grid more resilient. The legislature and Governor Perry refused to act. You know, this is just nonsense. It's not that we have equipment that's any different than any generation company in Kansas or Denver or Buffalo, New York. It's just the companies and the corporate governance and the leadership of the state, which is exercised through the Public Utility Commission and the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. It was all failing.
You're tuned to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, 90.1 FM and digital channel FMHD1. This is Houston's Community Station. We thank you for joining us. I'm Dwayne Bradley with Rick Campbell. We're visiting with Ed Herz, Energy Economics Professor at the University of Houston. Ed, following up on your baseball analogy, what would it take in changing the system currently in place where the players that are in the dugout, those generators that are potential but maybe not necessary today, what change to our current system would enable that to be a model that would work? And is that anything that you see on the horizon or in any process, perhaps as a result of the trauma that we are still actually dealing with as a result of this latest 2021 COVID pandemic Arctic vortex scenario.
We need to find a way to compensate the guys on the bench. And so, you know, the most expedient approach to this would be to the installation of a capacity market here in ERCOT, whereby the generation companies actually offer into the market the service of being ready to go at any moment. And that cost is then spread among everyone in Texas. Your bill would reflect that. It works to a certain extent. For example, in California, PJM, Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland has a capacity market. It's got some issues with market manipulation and gaming. You know, any time you try and replicate a free market solution with government direction and government committees, it's kind of like the camel that comes out of the committee that is asked to go design a horse. It doesn't work very well. And so that's what we have here. The great irony for the free market believers in Austin is, in essence, what they constructed with ERCOT was an old style Soviet industrial bureau where there's just one buyer picking amongst the different suppliers in the economy, really just on the basis of price. You know, it's not like you're going to get any kind of differentiation in how the electron is delivered to the consumer. And to further this comparison, ERCOT prices everything with its linear programming model. It's computer algorithms. You've heard about this. Well, the algorithm mispriced something, or the algorithm pointed to a negative price here and a $9,000 megawatt price there. You know, in the old days when I began to code computer programs, we were all acutely aware of GIGO, you know, garbage in, garbage out. ERCOT has spent more than $1 billion of Texans' money building this magnificent linear programming model. It's an optimization program. You know, Leonid Kantorovich and Chaling Koopmans were awarded the Nobel Prize for applying this technique that George Danzig had put together in 1975. Kantorovich protested when he was receiving the award at Stockholm. He said, no, I'm a physicist, because he received the award the same year of the massive Soviet grain failure, the crop failures across the Soviet Union. It seems that, you know, the great model that he had developed for operating the Soviet Union had no provision for what happens if the weather changes, had no provision for capital investment and return on capital. And that's exactly what the ERCOT model is lacking as well.
Mm. Well, speaking of weather and such, during the power outage, officials right here in Texas were going on national television blaming this failure on renewable energy sources like blades out in West Texas on these turbines freezing up, which was perhaps true in a micro sense, but overall impact on us and the grid overall was largely a lie. What do you read into that? Was there some end game strategy being put forth by officials in Texas to shunt blame?
You know, I have no idea what their motivations were. I mean, the grid began to go down at 1:38 in the morning. You know, certainly the governor couldn't have expected solar to be much of a help at that point. You know, wind was only estimated to be providing 7% of the draw that night, and we lost 30 gigawatts, for goodness sake. The failures seem to be pretty well distributed into the natural gas generation plants, coal plants. One of the nuclear power generation units tripped off because of a broken frozen valve in the water system, but that was pretty well restored relatively quickly. Yes, wind turbines went down. They were not equipped with de-icing equipment. Certainly wind turbines in Wyoming and Colorado have de-icing equipment. Yeah, this was a failure of those corporations to adequately plan. But, you know, this is essentially a smokescreen. The governor the lieutenant governor, the legislature, the Public Utility Commission, and ERCOT all knew the vulnerability of this grid system. And while they talk about it being a 1 in 100 year storm, that's just not the case, guys. I was here in 89 when we had several days of single digit temperatures and broken pipes and a grid that went down for a short while. And then in 2011. So, I mean, this is executive and legislative leadership with their collective heads in the sand, refusing to acknowledge the tremendous vulnerability of Texas infrastructure. You know, what I find really troubling comes from the testimony of the different parties that first week in front of the legislature. Number one, the fired CEO of ERCOT said that we were moments away from a complete failure of the ERCOT grid, border to border. We would have been down for months as we would try to recover from a black start, which is when no lines are energized. You know, this is an astonishing, frightening vulnerability for Texas. If Arizona and Southern California can come back from a black start in less than 24 hours, and the Northeast after the tree fell in Cleveland, which took out everybody, can be fully operational after a total of 4 days. I mean, how in the world does anyone justify having a Texas grid that could go down for months? This makes no sense. We would be a ward of the nation. You know, the social fabric would certainly break down. I mean, you know, no water, no power, no communications, no traffic lights, no medical services. I mean, guys, this would take down most of the petrochemical facilities along the Gulf Coast. This is an economic engine for the nation. And to reveal that vulnerability shows a complete lack of perspective, if you will, by the CEO of ERCOT. This is something that certainly did not need to be brought out in a public forum. Now we've got bad actors, domestic and foreign, who see Texas as a terribly weak link in U.S. national security.
That opens a lot of vulnerability and some questions about that here on the Third Coast. Thanks for tuning in. This is Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, Houston's community station. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Rick Kebble, and I'm sitting in for Stephanie Coleman. We're going to go back to our visit with Ed Hirsch, the energy economics professor and U of H energy fellow, and talk more about the deep freeze, the electrical grid, and what's ahead for us. Ed, I'd like to ask a simple question. What have we learned from this?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know that anybody has an answer for that just yet. Let me return to the legislative hearings. So the first point is that we've learned that we're in a much deeper mess than we thought we were, and potentially a critical failure in Texas could lead to a severe dislocation for the nation. The second point that came out of the legislative hearings, there was testimony, unsigned testimony from ICE Futures US. This is the commodities trading exchange where financial futures on electricity in the ERCOT market are traded. Contracts. You and I could buy contracts. Well, maybe not you and I, but commodities brokers, generators, retail electricity providers can buy and sell electricity in the financial market, as opposed to the physical market. ERCOT itself is the physical market for the trading of electrons, the production of electrons, the distribution of electrons. And like most commodities exchanges, we have financial contracts. We can think of this, it happens with oil, crude oil, WTI, natural gas, Henry Hub pricing. We've got the hog futures, corn futures. Well, we have electricity futures. And so I submitted testimony to the legislature complaining that we couldn't, we being Texas, could not reprice that electricity during the week because it would, of course, mean they'd have to unwind all of the trades that took place on ICE. This is kind of like the bookies in Vegas calling up the NFL and complaining about the way the fourth quarter was officiated. This is reinforced by this incredible phone call, Zoom call, that the Public Utility Commission chairman, DeAndrea, got on with the Bank of America, and he's assuring the Bank of America that he's not going to reprice any of the electricity so that the B of A investors, can keep their winnings, if you will, that they've been able to accrue. You know, guys, $50 billion got transferred from the consumer side of the ledger to the producer side of the ledger. And we don't know what the betting was going on over on ICE. It could have been a multiple. And, who the heck is running the state? When the governor stands up and says, we're not going to reprice, we're not going to backtrack on anything, we have to maintain the integrity of the market, when the market is clearly failed, you have to wonder, who's calling the shots here? So that's something we've learned. We don't know who's calling the shots. It's clear it's not the governor. We can speculate all we want. It's going to take a number of investigations by the state authorities and by the federal authorities to see where this money went. You know, we've learned that's a problem.
When I hear you say $50 billion that was transferred from one side of the ledger, that would be my pocket, into the other side of the ledger, that would be the producer's pocket. It makes me think about the fact that this was due to the fact that they, at least in large part, didn't bother to spend any money when they were advised to a decade ago by the federal regulators in the wake of the collapse of 2011, saying you really need to weatherize these facilities. And I think about, and was going to ask you, what if you knew what an estimate of the cost of weatherizing this grid would be, and then maybe juxtaposing that against the $50 billion that were transferred here recently, and whether we would maybe come out on the plus or minus side of that were it redirected to actually accomplish a goal that benefited, let's just say, we the people.
Well, not just we the people. I mean, we're customers, we're consumers, and we're trying to protect the entire state economy. The value of electricity is not in the cost of production. The value of electricity is in what it allows us to do. I mean, we're doing a radio show. We're communicating. We drive across town. Somebody has a red light. Somebody has a green light. Hopefully, we're paying attention. Medical. Food. The value of electricity is far in excess of its cost of delivery and production. We know that. If we had to create electricity, we'd spend a heck of a lot more for it than we do today. And in the across the globe with 1 to 2 billion people who don't have access to electricity, they would desperately love to be in our situation. And our situation is a first world problem that the state of Texas has let slip to become almost a third world problem with the reliability of the ERCOT grid. Uh-huh. And I find that just really quite distressing. The $50 billion, that's what was charged. ERCOT unilaterally set these prices, and they paid it out. There are a number of companies that have filed for bankruptcy, a number of co-ops that have. There are a number of companies waiting to see if they will be filing for bankruptcy. The disruptions on this are going to extend for a long time. And the cost of prevention, if you will, I've seen one estimate that roughly it's 1% of the generation base. And if you figure roughly $1 million per megawatt for the 75 gigawatts that we have available in Texas at any one point, that would mean $750 million worth of prevention. $750 million of winterization cost against the $50 billion that changed hands, against the $90 billion in property and casualty losses, 111 deaths. Now we're talking, the $750 million doesn't look that big, does it?
Right. It's all the matter of relativity, it sounds like.
Well, and exactly. And, you know, what makes the people in Kansas and Colorado and Buffalo, New York, smarter than Texans?
Don't have an answer for that one.
Well.
one more question here about this whole ERCOT thing is, as we know, the public utility commissioners were appointed by the governor. They all three resign. They hired the ERCOT people. The senior officials with ERCOT resigned as a result of that. What do you think the fallout's going to be politically for the governor's office and for legislators?
Well, you know, if the Texas Constitution were anything like the California Constitution, we'd be having a recall election right now. It's pretty clear that the executive leadership in Austin is hoping to get by this as fast as possible. And in the words of one public utility commissioner a couple of years ago, hoping that God gets us through the summer without a series of blackouts. My proposed solution was to take a look at what we did with the state money and the coach Tom Herman at UT. We bought his contract out for $15.4 million. We could do that, take that $15.4 million and buy out the governor, lieutenant governor, the legislators, all of the public utility commissioners, the executive leadership of ERCOT and the board of ERCOT, and have enough left over to send them on a vacation to Cancun.
Sounds like not a bad idea.
You're tuned into Open Journal on Pacifica KPFT here in Houston. We are visiting with Ed Herz, energy economics professor at the University of Houston. Ed, you had a recent op-ed piece in the Houston Chronicle, and earlier in this conversation you were talking about some of the exposure in revealing the deficiencies in the energy grid here in Texas to players both internally and externally, and some of whom don't have our best interest at heart. One of those plays into a scenario you mentioned in your op-ed piece that was actually part of the plot of a James Bond film back in, I believe, 1995, GoldenEye, and it involved the nuclear explosion creating an electromagnetic pulse wave that would send a shock through the system, literally. How much does that really concern you? And is that on a list that you could maybe expound on some of the vulnerabilities that have been revealed in this recent occurrence in Texas?
Well, I think the most critical vulnerability is if the grid were to go down totally and we'd have to take months to recover from with a black start, that's just beyond the pale. But the fact that we haven't addressed this, and this is obviously now a known vulnerability, and it's had to have existed for years until we got to March of 2021. Why hasn't investment been made to fix that? And so my concern is that just by shoring up the generators is not going to solve the critical weaknesses that we have exposed around the rest of the grid. The EMP, several former CIA directors go around the country talking about this. This is a well-known critical infrastructure issue that everyone in grid management is aware of. could be fixed with relatively small expense by the installation of Faraday cages around some of the critical switching equipment on the grid. Again, it's an expense. Cutting down trees that get close to power lines, well, that's an expense too, and utilities don't like spending that money until there's a hurricane that comes through. The grid is under constant attack with cyber attacks. Occasionally one or two slip through. In India, a large section of their grid powered down this year because of a malicious software attack. Most of these get repelled here in the United States. One of the neat things of having an old grid in place is perhaps the systems are not as vulnerable. In one tour of a nuclear power plant, we asked the operator, are you worried about cyber attacks? And the operator pointed out, we're using the best technology that 1968 has to offer. And so, not terribly concerned about a cyber attack in a nuclear power plant. But for switchgear, for transformers, for power, this is an issue we have to address. The grid is also vulnerable to targeted attacks. And we've seen that here in Texas and other places around the nation where, folks go up with some dynamite and try and blow something up. Ordinarily, those particular incidents can be kind of walled off pretty quickly. It just begs the question of what is the actual state of the grid around Texas? We don't have any visibility into any kind of assessment. ERCOT is remarkably opaque. The Public Utility Commission, equally so. And we're seeing a lot of that over the last couple of weeks as public information requests are made to ERCOT and the Public Utility Commission, and these are being repelled. The governor is not responding. He's turned all his text and communications during the crisis over to the Attorney General. So, in a situation where so much of the livelihood of a state depends upon the actual executive management of critical infrastructure, it's I think incumbent upon us to expect transparency.
Okay. Well, I was wanting to leave our listeners, Ed Hirsch, with the best way for people to keep up with you and what you're working on and what you're doing. Would that be simply edhirs.com, edhirsch.com? Is that a good link for folks to keep in touch and keep up with what's going on in your world and the greater world of energy economics?
Yes, it is. The website has my class notes, if you will, over the years, opinion pieces, some research, carbon pricing, for example, recommendations for oil and gas policy, pipeline policy, some of our research papers, and and occasionally a strategic piece. So that works. I'm also on Twitter at Ed Hirsch, easily enough. I'm there also.
Well, we greatly appreciate you spending time with us on this expanded open journal conversation, and thank you so much for joining us, Ed Hirsch.
It's my pleasure joining, and Ray, thank you.
It is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. We thank you for joining us. Thanks for the gift of your time, and thank you for supporting Houston's community station. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Rick Campbell, sitting in for Stephanie Coleman, who will be back with us next week. Our programs are archived at kpft.org, and you can subscribe to our podcast, KPFTOJ, where podcasts can be found. We are a dedicated all-volunteer top-tier production staff, including Susan Phillips and Maverick. Open Journal theme music is by Kevin MacLeod. Join us on Open Journal next time for more great conversations, and thank you, as always, for your support.
And as always, we like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes to us from Mae Jemison, who said, "I like to think of ideas as potential energy. They're really wonderful, but nothing will ever happen until we risk putting them into action." Take care of each other. Peace.